Recently, there's been considerable talk about the fine art of debunking, that interesting practice whereby public heroes are cut down to size and public enthusiasm systematically dampened. What's chiefly prompted our speculations on this topic has been the storm we've been able to observe over in England, where a few months ago, in a book by Richard Aldington, T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, received extremely rough treatment. My own interest in debunking is shared by Napier Wilt, professor of English and dean of the Division of Humanities at the University of Chicago, who is with me on this side of the Atlantic. Over in London, our guests are Sir Harold Nicholson, author, lecturer, and former diplomat, and A.J.P. Taylor, historian of Magdalen College, Oxford. Am I right in saying, Mr. Wilt, that we in America are rather surprised by the extraordinary heat which Aldington's debunking of Lawrence seems to have generated in England?
Yes, I think so. Of course, we realize that Lawrence is a much greater hero in England than he ever was and certainly is now in this country. But even so, it seems to me that an attack on a popular hero should be taken for granted. Ever since the 20s, we rather assume that anybody who attains the height of being a hero is going to be debunked within a week or two. And I'm a bit surprised that there has been so much controversy raised over this particular biography, even admitting that it's a rather inferior piece of work.
Mr. Taylor, what is your feeling about this? Are we right in assuming that there has been a great deal of heat in England over this Lawrence matter?
I think there's been a certain amount, particularly among older people who took part in the first wave of Lawrence enthusiasm. And I'll give you an explanation of it. It's a curious point that the Lawrence myth, the build-up of Lawrence as a hero, has been rather a sham affair, rather a made affair all the time. As far back as I can remember, there have been people writing hysterical, exaggerated books about Lawrence immediately after the war. Even during the First War, popular magazines did it. He was deliberately plugged. And mind you, he was very skillful at plugging himself. Nobody has been a smarter advertiser. And I think that it's this heightening of the tempo. Look at any of the pro-Lawrence biographies. Look at the things which, say, Winston Churchill said about him. Well, they're so grotesquely exaggerated that it's not surprising that we get grotesque exaggeration on the other side.
Do you feel the same way, Sir Harold?
Yes, I do, most certainly. I'd go further. You see, there was a great deal about little Lawrence which did not qualify him to be a schoolboy hero, which he was. I mean, he was an untruthful man. He was a very vain man. I think he was rather a cruel man. He was all the things that schoolboys are taught not to be. And that therefore, when schoolmasters and parents and boys were suddenly told that their hero was really had feet of very, very bad quality clay, there was a shock. I think there'd have been a similar shock with you if, let us say, in 22 or 23, somebody had written a book debunking Charles Lindbergh. They couldn't have done so because he was undebunkable.
Then, in general, you would agree that the Lawrence myth needs debunking, but I judge from what you've said, you object to the manner in which Aldington is doing it.
Well, I certainly objected to the manner because I thought it was a dull book, not very well proportioned, insisting upon unimportant things, not insisting upon the really important thing, and was a bad book. That's what I felt about it.
It's very unreadable, isn't it?
Well, it comes as rather a shock to me to think that a bad book, restoring proportions which you feel inevitably should have been restored, has created a sensation. I repeat that I find it rather difficult to imagine a thing of that sort occurring here. The Lindbergh matter that you raise is, of course, probably unthinkable because there aren't the grounds for this kind of debunking. But on the other hand, it seems to me that we've had a climate of skepticism here in our biographical writing and in a good many other kinds of writing over the last 20 or 30 years to which the American people are almost conditioned, and in consequence that the Americans wouldn't respond with anything like the alarm and the hot temper and whatnot that we've seen going on in England since this Aldington book was written.
You know, you slipped rather a fast one over on me there. If you'd warned me that you were going to say that Lindbergh was entitled to be placed on a pedestal and that he was gold throughout, I might have studied the question and discovered, not no doubt the things that discredited Lawrence, but other things which I think would have been true and would have shocked Americans. In fact, you've really given us our case, that you regard it as inconceivable that Lindbergh could be debunked in any way. Fine, we can let that go. Now let me take up your other point where you say there's been a lot of skepticism in American biographies in the last 30 years. I'm not sure skepticism's the right word. Debunking is a good word because it seems to me that American biography is still either all white or all black. That the moment that you take a man off a pedestal, then he has to be broken up in pieces and presented as a scoundrel. President Roosevelt is a case in point. The people who've criticized his policy in America haven't, it seems to me, said, as we often do about even Churchill in this country, that there were bound to be elements of expediency which couldn't always come out at the time, but that they have, the isolationists, for instance, have built him up as a almost a criminal, as an alternative to being a national hero.
Didn't only the isolationists have done that.
I don't agree with you on that. I think in the American biographies, even of political current heroes, you certainly have some criticism, some admitting of the fact that they occasionally act from expediency instead of being God-directed. Would you mention a few of the English biographies that you think make neither a hero nor a villain of the subject, of important political figures?
Well, Professor Wilt, I think the important thing, before we go much further, is to decide what date we're talking about. Because in English biography, a great change, and I think in yours too, a great change came over the scene after the 19th century.
Well, why?
Well, because in the 19th century you were discussing synthetic types. You wanted to produce a synthetic type. In the 20th century, we want to produce an analysis of character, and they're different things. And therefore, I think that occurred in both countries. But I think with us that the process of analysis has not gone quite as far as with you. And that we are getting a little bored with it, I think. That's one of the things, go back for a minute to Aldington's book, he makes this enormous song and dance about Lawrence's great secret, which wasn't a secret at all, and the effect upon him. It had no effect upon his brother, who was a perfectly normal human being. I think all that sort of psychoanalytical thing is carried a little too far in the United States.
We certainly have had a good deal of it ever since the 20s, Crouch's Edgar Allan Poe, the Vanwick Brooks, the ordeal of Mark Twain, and so on. But you're not implying, are you, that you're not to use some kind of psychological analysis in interpreting character?
I would say this about the Edgar Allan Poe book, that he taught me a very great deal which I hadn't understood before. I thought it was a very good book. But that I think that the method can be exaggerated and overemphasized. I do.
I would draw a very sharp distinction between biographies of writers, perhaps of all creative artists, and biographies of political figures, politicians, and so on. The writer is, after all, expressing his personality, and a great deal of that personality is probably mysterious even to himself. And that, therefore, even if you like a psychoanalytical biography, it's going to help us to understand a man's writing more. I think that's been true of, say, Dickens in this country in the last 10 or 20 years, that the Dickens has become perhaps an infinitely greater writer in our eyes because we understand more of this terrible inner conflict which he didn't grasp himself. Whereas with politicians, they are public figures. And if they have psychological conflicts, if they've had some terrible disappointment at the age of 2, I don't think it's frightfully important.
Yes. Could I ask Professor Wilt a question, which carries on what Taylor's just said? Now, I think one of the most revealing things that I experiences of that sort was reading the life of Emily Dickinson, whose poems I'd admired enormously for a long time, and going to our house and seeing her room and all that. That seemed to me frightfully illuminating, and her poems took life on, after I'd read the books, two books I'd read on her, and seen her home. Wouldn't you agree, Wilt, that in literary biographies, as Taylor says, it is essential to know the facts before you can understand the poetry?
Well, that depends on what you mean. Certainly a great many of the facts about Emily Dickinson's life and the relation of her life to her poetry are questions that certainly over here seem not to be settled. We need a great deal more of illumination. Haven't you, though, this difficulty that unless your interpretation is very sound, that it is likely to misdirect the reading of the author's work, to throw an emphasis on it that is not there. I'm thinking of some of the interpretations of Jede that I've seen. And it seems to me a two-edged sword any way you look at it. It illuminates, but it also may illuminate in the wrong way.
Oh, yes, I'm assuming that it's an honest and intelligent and well-informed book, but I'm merely saying that I agree very much with Della, that the life of a public man, therefore a man whose life and thought is mainly external, you don't need, it isn't as illuminating as the life of a literary person, especially so frightfully private a literary person as Emily Dickinson, does enable one to understand their products better.
Oh, certainly.
Well, of course, isn't it true, however, that there are many unresolved questions surrounding the life of political figures and of public figures, and the mere fact that the life of a man like Lawrence, or if you will, the life of a man like Roosevelt, is susceptible of all kinds of interpretations, suggests that any resources which are open to the biographer are legitimate ones on which to draw.
Yes, and I think more than that, you know, that over the years, our tastes, not only in biography, but in our sort of picture of ourselves change. I was thinking, when you were talking about 19th century biography and how this is very pompous and official, every one of the readers of those biographies was equally pompous and official in his own life. Let's think back to our grandfathers or great-grandfathers. They were all most rigidly dressed with thick gold watch chains and heavy whiskers that were carefully done up, and they presented themselves as heroes to their children, to their employees, whoever it might be. Now, our line, I don't know what yours may be in America, but our line in England nowadays is that we're all very humble, what's called common folk. The father doesn't pass himself off any longer as a hero to his children. He tries to show that he's just as young and frivolous and irresponsible as they are. And I think it's the whole change in the pattern of our life which demands a different kind of biography.
Do you think that that is likely to last longer than the other? Aren't we rather working pretty hard at being frivolous and informal when we probably are not any more than the Victorians were the heroes they were making themselves out to be?
I dare say there'll be another fashion. I like to think that we are being more natural and genuine. And the Victorians would have been ashamed if either of the words was applied to them.
Well, it's certainly conceivable that we've created a myth of being what one might call in this country just plain folks.
After all, the heroes do conform to what the public want. Would you talk a little bit as to why Lawrence assumed this heroic proportions in the late 20s or in the 20s in general? I have a theory about it, and I'd like to bring that up after you're through. Why did Lawrence make this tremendous appeal? Why did he?
Oh, well, I think the thing is a very natural human one, and the same as Lindbergh, that we'd all been brought up, I mean, the people of my generation, we'd all been brought up to think of war as a heroic thing, and we learnt by bitter experience that it was very unheroic, impersonal, squalid, muddy. And naturally, we tended to want to get back a little bit of our heroism, our romanticism. And the picture of this young undergraduate with his golden hair dashing across the desert upon a camel and doing wonderful things single-handed. Or the picture, the other young man with the golden hair, flying as a lone eagle across the Atlantic, they corresponded to the romance that we'd been denied. And that was why it blew up.
Well, wasn't it true also that both Lindbergh and Lawrence, and particularly Lawrence, conformed to the sort of non-hero hero? After all, Lawrence attacked the stuffed shirts. He was very nasty to people in high places. He was not in the regular service.
He said he was.
I think, you know, Lawrence did work that in himself later on. The truth is he was built up as a schoolboy hero at the beginning and then enjoyed, I think, running down the grade, but also enjoyed being perpetually in their company. Lawrence used to go around in cog trying to look like an ordinary man, but he was furious when people didn't recognize him in the streets. He walked along in ordinary soldier's uniform, but he expected the crowds to turn round. But this was something special. But the proof of the fact that, Lawrence was artificially built up to supply the missing hero is shown, I think, very strikingly by the Second War, where we had in this country at least a dozen people who did things more dramatic, more heroic, more romantic than Lawrence. And they all wrote books about them, and they've all had considerable success. You know, I mean, people have bought the books, but nobody takes them particularly seriously. Most of them are back now as bank clerks or in the civil service or whatever it is. Heroes in this country are to a penny.
Well, how do you account for the change that's occurred between wars?
Because in the Second War, we did have lots of heroes. Because in the Second War, there was lots of fun. It was very exciting, the whole North African affair, the resistance. It was a dramatic war. One of the strangest things about it is that most of the people who came back from the war, except the ones in the Navy, had thoroughly enjoyed it.
How much do you think that the Lawrence myth was aided by Lloyd George finding him and his position very useful at the time of the Paris Peace Conference? Is Aldington right on that?
Oh, I don't think that at all. I don't think Lloyd George liked Lawrence very much, and Lawrence certainly disliked Lloyd George very much. And Lloyd George was terrified, really terrified by the complications Lawrence introduced in Paris Conference. I was there, I know. He was a nuisance.
Did you know Lawrence or Harold? You must have.
Oh, yes, I knew him well.
Nicholson,
I disliked him very much.
Isn't it true that Churchill rather built him up in 1919?
Yeah, Churchill built him up. You see, Churchill likes courage so very much. And he thinks it makes up for everything else.
I wonder, gentlemen, if I can revert to the original question that I asked. You've been talking, I think, in a very interesting fashion about the circumstances under which a hero comes into being, about the circumstances in which the people in general are very anxious to create a myth. Let me ask once again whether you feel that there's any important difference between American tendencies in this connection and those one finds in England.
Our inclination is to feel that we have quite a lot of heroes around who, when it comes to a war or something dramatic, do it quite nicely, and that there's nothing all that remarkable about it, though it's interesting enough to read about. Real heroes of biography at the present time are, I think, of a different nature. I'm afraid that they're great scientists and people of this kind, that they attract far more admiration than the merely heroic. Whether this is a good thing, I'm not at all sure.
Yes, but now, would Professor Wilt agree with what is only an impression with me, and I'd like him to knock it sky high, that the success story biography is more popular in the United States than here?
Now you're documenting what seems to have been your earlier assertion, that if there's more debunking here, it's because there's more bunk, and you cite the success story as an example of it. What would you say in our defense, Mr. Wilt?
I would say the success story has been on the decline for quite a while, and there is a great deal. This goes back to the 20s. A student of mine has been working on just that subject, and any writer, any artist, any man who was a great success, particularly commercial success in the 20s, was automatically brought down by the critics. We, beginning with the 20s, I think, have a very much of an anti-success complex. I'm not sure that's recognized as much as it might be, but I think it's very true.
I'm terribly grateful to you in London for participating in this discussion today. We have heard from England, Sir Harold Nicholson, author, lecturer, and diplomat, and A.J.P. Taylor, historian of Magdalen College. While in this country, we have heard from Napier Wilk, professor of English and dean of the Division of Humanities at the University of Chicago. Now, this is Edward Rosenheim returning you to Radio Central in New York.